on 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
Hello everyone and welcome to Science Spinning here on 103.2 Dublin City FM, the show with an Irish spin on science with me, Sean Duke. Today we'll be asking, do animals have the same moral rules that we have? Do they play by our own rules? Are we the only animal in the forest that lives by a moral code? Well, I'll be talking to Dale Peterson. He's a researcher and writer based at Tufts University, which is in Boston in the USA. He's written about this and he's had a long-standing interest in primates and other animals. We'll also be talking to Niall Smith. He's the head of research at Cork Institute of Technology about a huge 32-metre deep space radio telescope that's under development in Cork. The telescope will be capable of detecting many things, such as bad weather on Jupiter, star explosions, solar storms on the surface of the sun, and certainly it's exciting that we have something of that capability here in Ireland. But first up today, we'll be talking animals and the morality of animals with author Dale Peterson. And just to welcome to the show from Boston, USA. Welcome, Dale.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Right. Thanks a lot for coming on. So maybe you could tell us, I did some research on the web, and you come from an English literature background originally. So how did you get interested in this whole area of animal research and primates and things like that?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but it's true I have a PhD in English literature, but I've spent the last 30 years being a professional writer about science subjects.
Okay, so you're like myself, actually. I started off with a similar background and I got into science. So what was the trigger for you to get interested in?
Well, I think the trigger was probably, you know, part of my personality.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to become a professor of English. I had broader interests.
Okay. Okay, now you started to work with a famous researcher, Jane Goodall, on primates, and I guess maybe that's where you might have started to see that animals can have moral rules the same as we do?
Well, that's right. I originally got into the subject of primates, animals, and particularly primates, on my own. I just jumped in with both feet and traveled around the world and looked at primates in tropical forests and wrote a first book on the subject. And then I met Jane Goodall, and she and I worked together to write a book about chimpanzees, and we've also collaborated since then on a few other books. So she's a good friend, and she taught me chimps, and
okay.
I learned about chimps from her. Okay. One of the first things that I learned is that chimpanzees have an incest taboo.
Hmm.
And it's kind of counterintuitive. We automatically think that only humans are smart enough and have the language ability to construct something like an incest taboo. But chimps very much have the same thing.
And how do other chimps in chimp society know then that somebody's committed incest, or do they punish them for it?
No, they don't, and they don't have the complex system of punishments that we have. So it's more individual, but it's very strong. Mothers and sons almost never mate, virtually never, and brothers and sisters very seldom. And when a brother attempts to mate with a sister, the sister will resist. So there's a lot of inhibition, internal, emotional inhibition against having sex with a close relative. And it's also expressed more fully in the larger social system, because females tend to leave the community of their birth.
Okay.
And that's another way of inhibiting incest.
Okay. Now you've written many books, but your most recent one is The Moral Lives of Animals. And so what were you attempting to achieve in that particular book?
Well, it's kind of an unusual idea that most people haven't thought about, and yet I think it can be fully argued. It's not an original idea. You know, Darwin stated in 1871 that, you know, I can quote here, besides love and sympathy, animals exhibit other qualities connected with the social instincts, which in us would be called moral.
Mm-hmm.
So Darwin was thinking along these lines, and essentially he was realizing that with evolution comes evolutionary continuity between species,
mm-hmm.
not only physical anatomical continuity, but emotional and psychological continuity. So that's really the heart of the argument, that animals have morality. It's part of the psychological continuity between species.
Okay, can you give us examples, say elephants perhaps, maybe look at elephants. There are examples of elephants stopping to help other elephants in trouble, maybe tell listeners about that.
Yes, well, you know, one aspect, not the only one by any means, of morality is compassion. And elephants are actually a remarkably compassionate species, very unusually so, I think,
mm-hmm.
Possibly as compassionate or empathetic as people are certainly in the same realm. There was a wonderful actual study done of wild forest elephants. This happened in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
It was done actually by a friend of mine who happened to be observing wild forest elephants in the forest of Central African Republic. She was at a clearing in the forest where elephants came for mud wallows. They came for the mud and for the water. And so there were a lot of elephants coming and going into this clearing. One day, as she sat there in June of 2000, she watched a young elephant die.
Mm.
And the dying took place over about a day. The elephant collapsed, became unconscious, and then by the end of the day, she was dead. And the next day, so she observed the elephant dying on one day, and day two, the elephant was dead.
Mm.
She happened to have a video camera with a telescopic lens, so she videotaped all of the other elephants in this large number of elephants, in this group of elephants, as they passed by. And she looked, and then she later had a separate person analyze the reactions. 50% of the reactions were fear and flight. The elephant saw a dead elephant, and they turned around and ran, as, you know, it's kind of appropriate because there are poachers in this area, so
mm-hmm.
seeing a dead elephant is a sign of danger. 18% of them stopped and tried to help. And the way they tried to help is kind of typical for elephants facing an elephant who has fallen down or collapsed. They tried to revive her by raising her up on her feet.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd use their tusks, they would use their feet, they would use their trunks and try to revive her. I've seen a video of this, and it's a very, very touching thing, because not only are they trying, but they're sort of screaming very emotionally, about the situation. So they're calling out, and you can sort of feel the emotion.
Mm.
So 18% tried to help, and then another 13% stood there and defended the body. So from attacks or from incursions by other elephants. So, combine the 18 and the 13 helping in defense.
That's quite a substantial, similar enough to humans.
And what it reminds me of is the wonderful story in the Bible of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Let me remind you of the story. You know, a man is attacked by robbers. I think it's the road to Jericho from Jerusalem. Attacked by robbers, stripped naked, injured, and left to die.
Mm-hmm.
And then three men walk along the road. Two of the men, very good, upstanding men, see the body or see the dying man, and they rush to the other side of the road and hurry on away. Naturally, that's a fear response, and the natural fear is there might be robbers still there. The third one stops to help. So what is the difference between the three men walking along the road? According to Jesus in the Bible, my translation of it, the difference was the first two men listened to their fear. The third man listened to his compassion. These are both emotional experiences.
Okay.
And the compassionate man followed his compassion, ignored his fear, and helped the dying man alongside the road.
Sure.
Well, 50% of them listen to their fear, and about 30% of them listen to their compassion.
Yeah.
And they stop to try and help or to defend dying elephant.
Sure. I mean, these are cases where they're doing it not necessarily in their own interest. This is just to, there's nothing necessarily in it for them. There's a story here that you mentioned, a chimpanzee in a zoo loses his own life trying to save an unrelated infant, somebody else's kid, basically, who's fallen into the water. So that's like, somebody sees somebody in the river and they jump in to save them, even if it's a stranger.
Right, yeah. And to return the elephant example, it happened that these elephants had been studied long enough by scientists that they knew the relationships between them. And there was no connection between family relationship and helping behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So strangers who had, there were no sense that they had known this dying elephant or her mother would stop as likely as family members.
Mm. Now, does this kind of raise questions then about how we use animals for food, for example? I mean, where do you stand on that after all your studies? Do you think that that's a moral thing for us to do?
Well, I mean, it's a different question and
sure.
a different set of questions, and I don't tackle it in the book. So my goal is to talk about animal morality.
Sure. But they're sophisticated creatures, and they have a sense of morality.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I hope it will, people reading the book will gain perhaps a greater respect for animals in general. And, what that leads to is the subject of somebody else's book.
Sure, okay, so, no problem. Now, is this just confined to the higher animals, if you like, the elephants or the chimps, or, can say the lower animals, maybe something like a rat or a mouse, can they be moral?
Well, I don't use higher and lower
as
an idea. I use different.
Mm.
But I do focus on the mammals, particularly, because I think their moral systems are close enough to ours that we really can understand it. When you get beyond the mammals to, say, reptiles, I think they have moral systems, but they're distant enough and remote enough that most people, it's just a harder argument to make.
Okay.
Having said that, let's look at rats. There are a lot of things we don't know about rats or don't appreciate about rats. I love a study that a fellow did in the middle of the United States, Ohio, I think, where he discovered that rats are laughing when they play.
Mm,
and
amazing.
And if you can believe that laboratory rats actually laugh, but he did this incredible experiment. They laugh when they're tickled. They laugh when they're playing. Laughing rats are more popular among the other rats. The only thing is it's beyond human hearing, so you can't hear it. You need special equipment to hear it. Anyway, on the subject of rat morality, I don't think it's as complex as human morality, and I don't even think their levels of empathy are as high as, say, the empathy of elephants.
Mm.
But having said that, there was a wonderful experiment done some time ago in which 20 rats were put in a cage with a glass partition in it, and on the other side of the partition, they could watch a rat who was being distressed,
mm-hmm.
being caused to have distress, and the way the rat was distressed was placed in a tiny little corset and then hooked up to a device that would raise them off the ground.
Doesn't sound good.
It made them anxious, and they would respond to being anxious by wiggling and wiggling their legs and acting frantic. And so the watching rats, how did they respond? Well, the way it was tested was they had a bar in the cage. They could press the bar to lower the distressed rat.
Mm.
Did they do that? Yes, they did. Significantly more than average or random. And as a comparison group, the experimenters then raised a piece of styrofoam in the same device and the rats in the other cage watching the styrofoam didn't respond in any way other than randomly. So you see from that that they do respond, and they do have what you might call a helping response to another rat in distress. It's just an interesting experiment. I'm not saying that rats are elephants, because they're not. They're rats.
Sure.
But, anyway.
Well, certainly it sounds like people might have their whole view of different types of animals challenged if they read your book. And
I hope they do.
it's certainly online. I tried to find it in Dublin, but I'm sure you know the stores will get it in soon because they've some of your other books.
Right.
And it's the moral lives of animals. And we're just talking to the author there, Dale Peterson from the United States. Thanks, Dale, for coming on and telling us all about that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Now, just while we're keying up our next guest, a couple of items just to mention. The CRAN Institute, which is a research institute based in Trinity College, Dublin, is offering a work placement this summer for a science teacher. They say this is a unique opportunity to spend 6 weeks in the research institute at Trinity College to learn more about nanoscience in this world-class facility. CRAN says that you don't need a great knowledge of nanoscience, but what you do need is enthusiasm, creativity, good research and writing skills are essential. If you're interested in applying for that work placement, you can email Mary at CRAN, and Mary is at Coakley, that's Coakley, Coakley at Coakley at Coaclum at tcd.ie. And if you didn't manage to write that down, you can call 896-3022, 896-3022. And the deadline for that, if you're a teacher listening, is Friday the 3rd of June. Okay, now we're going to move on. And it was very interesting to learn that Ireland now has a very large telescope, a radio telescope. It's 32 metres in size, which is very large. It was built originally in 1984 to take transatlantic calls from Europe to the United States. It was retired out of use in the mid-1990s when the undersea cables linking North America and Europe were laid into Ireland. But now it's been brought out of its retirement, and it's been refitted for use as a deep space radio telescope. It's an initiative of Cork Institute of Technology and the National Space Centre. And I've Niall Smith, he's the head of research at Cork Institute of Technology, on the line to tell us about it. Hi, Niall.
Hi, Sean, how are you?
This sounds like a great idea. So I had no idea that we had this huge satellite dish down in Middleton in County Cork.
Yeah, I think most of us, quite frankly, didn't know we had this huge decommissioned dish down in Cork. So it was, I guess, something of a surprise when we found out, even in CIT, that there was a 32-metre that had been essentially decommissioned and mothballed and was sitting there staring up at the skies, but no detectors that would actually bring it back to life. So, yeah, a couple of months ago only, the National Space Centre they're a company.
Who are they now?
Sean, but
they're a company.
Yeah, they're a company, and their business is actually to move content, as they put it, to satellites from the ground. So
what might that be then, content? Just so give people
content
a picture.
Could be television, yeah. Content, and it could come from sort of from anywhere in the world, or it could be satellite earth observation content, so you know, for flooding or for crops or whatever. Basically, they don't get involved in the except in terms of the appropriateness of content.
Yes.
They only get involved in the transmission and retransmission. And there's a series of radio telescopes, radio dishes around Europe that get involved in this type of work. And in part, as I understand it, I'm not part of the NSC, Sean, but as I understand it, it's partly to give us an independence in our capacity to move content around, rather than relying, say, on one satellite and one dish, which, if it gets switched off, then, you know, there's no backup.
So is this TV going back and forth between U.S. and Europe? Is that kind of thing?
It could be Middle East. It could be Asia. It could be anywhere. I mean, they kind of get bounced around from satellites to ground stations, maybe to other satellites and so forth. So that, for example, if you want to watch something live from Kuala Lumpur now, it may not be possible to get it back to Ireland directly via one satellite feed. It may have to go through a couple of satellite feeds from you know, uplinks and downlinks. And I don't know if you've ever done something, Sean, where you listen on the radio and you watch on the TV.
Oh, I've done it, for Gaelic matches.
Yeah, and sometimes you'll find that actually you realise a goal has just been scored on the radio and the
TV lag.
Is lagging. In part, it's because of that type of moving the data around in a way which, you know, probably surprises us all. So,
now, a 32-metre dish, that's quite large, isn't it?
105 feet, it's enormous. I have to say, it's a really impressive engineering, piece of engineering. It's fantastic sort of just standing there, being in its presence, let alone...
Where is it? Is it in a field somewhere, or is it in
It is, effectively it is. The site itself is about 5 minutes out from the Jameson Distillery in Middleton.
Yeah.
And you can actually see it in the distance. You can see it from Middleton, actually, if you're sort of on the right road. So you can actually see the 32-metre from the distance. And the locals would know it well and so on.
Mm,
I mean, there's no radiation issues associated with the site. You know, it's the 32, for example, doesn't, as you said, it used to be used for transatlantic phone calls, but it's only potentially now used as a receiver, so it doesn't generate any radiation or anything like that. So
just tell people, when we actually laid these undersea cables, then how did it change when we're making calls between Ireland or Europe and US? Then this dish was doing what?
So this dish was kind of in part a backup, and also it was a secure line. So there was always this issue that you could maybe tap into. To underwater cabling, as it was at the time, and so this was a separate way of doing that. At its peak, I think this is sort of an interesting statistic. It could carry 300 phone calls simultaneously.
Right.
I mean, today we would just laugh at that. 300 phone calls simultaneously. Now you're talking about hundreds of thousands,
exactly.
Not millions. So, but that kind of shows the technology. And in fact, one of the fascinating things about the site is that the control equipment literally takes up an enormous room. And today you can replace it with a single PC.
Right, a laptop can do the same job.
Absolutely, a laptop is probably 10 times more powerful than the technology back in sort of 84, or even the early to mid-90s, you know, as you know, computing power has changed so much.
Well, that's when I went to college, 84, but that's a long time ago now.
I'm keeping quiet.
Say nothing. Yeah. So when did this come to your attention then, that it was actually there?
Yeah, so it came to our attention. It was there literally, I guess, about sort of 6 months ago. And then a couple of months ago, the owners of the site came to us and said, we've been looking at a use for the dish. We don't, at the moment, have an obvious commercial application for it. And as part, effectively, of the sort of corporate social responsibility, we'd like to see something being done with it. But so they had talked with a couple of different groups, and our approach was, well, there's not a lot of money around at the moment. So while you could, for example, put very expensive detectors on this system, you know, you could put up sort of the souped-up engine in the car, or you could put in the 1 litre, which will get you from A to B, and you can do very nice things with it. And in a sense, what we're doing, when we talked with them, we said to them, well, look, we could do something very quickly, get it up and running, and get it now detecting radiation again. And the thing is a little bit like what I think about the equipment from 1984. The detectors that you can get today that are relatively inexpensive are still so much better than the ones you could have, you know, bought for a million, say, you know, 10 years ago. So you can actually, for relatively little money, you can do very well.
Right.
So it's all about, in a sense, not necessarily, let's put it say, it's imagine 32 meters of dish sitting there doing nothing, or 32 meters sitting there doing something really interesting, even though it may not be the very best that you could do with it.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's a great idea because it's not being used.
It's a value for money idea, Sean, by the way. That's kind of value for money, of course.
Yeah. Now, when I think of deep space radio telescopes, I tend to think of the film Contact, you know, those huge telescopes, and where they were trying to tune in to see if they could hear aliens and all kinds of stuff.
Yep.
But that's not what it's going to be doing, is it?
It's not. I mean, I'd use an analogy. If you were looking up in the sky with your eyes, which you might do. And there was some extraterrestrial civilization with a huge big light, and they shone it in your direction. You'd see it.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't necessarily have to be looking for it. So in the same way, we're going to be looking at the skies for particular things, if there happened to be a signal that was there, which was clearly of an interesting structure, like, you know, like in the film context, you reconstruct a picture of a video footage of Hitler or something like that.
An artificial signal.
Then you'd say, okay, this is something interesting or whatever. But if that would happen completely by chance, that's not what we're going to be looking for.
And we
absolutely wouldn't expect to find anything or anything like that. So, I mean, as I said, I wouldn't want to be disrespectful to programs that are looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, but we're not going to be
that's not your territory. Yeah, sure, okay. Now, there's a big schools outlet here, because obviously this is an opportunity maybe for schools to go visit this and learn, or maybe even use the equipment, something.
So we have you hit a nail on the head. The key thing for us for this is part of our public outreach and schools initiative, and we all know of issues to do with science and engineering and the problems with maths and so on. So what we have is CIT, the institute, operates also another facility called Blackrock Castle Observatory in Cork, and it's specifically designed to encourage, enthuse, and excite kids and their parents about science.
So you have that one in place. So this one's different, obviously. Yeah.
And this exactly will link into that, but not everybody lives in Cork. So what you want is using, if you like, what we've learned by running a science centre in Cork. Now, it does already link nationally, but nevertheless, use that expertise to connect schools nationally so that they'll be able to, for example, listen in on what the radio telescope is looking at the minute, and also then be able to see, oh, it's now looking at, let's say, a quasar, and what is a quasar? And our view on it is that if you were sitting in a classroom and you were able to, with your teacher, to log on, and rather than just sort of, you know, see a graph out of a book, you actually saw a live signal coming to you, coming to this place in Ireland, our belief is, from all the work we've done in other programs, that this will get kids more interested, and therefore they can start discussions in the classroom. And what we intend to do is to develop little curricular-based learning worksheets to get young and not so young, because in principle, John, you can do quite sophisticated things with the data, but you can also do relatively simple but very exciting things with the data. And so we'll guide teachers as to the sorts of things to ask the kids, the sort of things to get them to think about, and so on, so that hopefully when they do their maths or they do their bit of physics or chemistry, that they might be thinking about the chemistry on another planet or on a star or something.
Get the imagination going.
Get the imagination going, exactly.
Yeah, sure. You know? Now, we're just running out of time now. So maybe if teachers or whomever wants to contact you about this, and I think it's a great initiative, how do they get in touch with you?
So probably the simplest thing to do is if they connect to our website or send an email to info@bco.ie.
Okay, info@bco.ie. Okay, that's great. Sorry, we're just out of time here.
But thanks a million,
John. Thanks for coming on and telling us about that.
Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Niall Smith. He's head of research at Cork Institute of Technology, telling us about a new telescope, deep space radio telescope, that'll be made available for schools and anyone else that is interested. Okay, that's all we have for this week. Thanks for listening. Check out the latest edition of Science Spin magazine. That's Ireland's only popular science magazine. I'm one of the editors there, which is just out. It's available in all Eason outlets and other news agents for €5. That's the hard copy. But if you want to get it for free, we'll email it to you. If you visit us online at sciencespin.com, just give us your email. Also, if you want to listen to any previous episodes of this program, Science Spinning, they're now available on my own blog site, which is at seanduke.com, seanduke.com. There's some other material there as well. Meanwhile, if you'd like to contact me about the show for any reason, I'd love to hear from you. My email here is sciencespinning@dublincityfm.ie. So, bye-bye for now. Talk to you again next week at 3:30 on Thursday afternoon. Bye-bye.